Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have the Pakistani foreign minister's plans to travel to China, Russia, and Turkey in hashing out a multipolar response to Trump's Afghan plans. No dates have been set for this grand Eurasian tour just yet, but it'll probably take place sometime next month. Mr. Khawaja Mohammad Asif will be embarking on an important mission to bring together the already converging positions of his country's top international partners into a cohesive strategy that can peacefully counter Trump's aggressive wartime plans for Afghanistan. China is Pakistan's top ally, and the two great powers have a decades-long history of full-spectrum cooperation. So it's logical why Islamabad would seek to coordinate its policies with Beijing. Ties between Pakistan and Turkey have always been on a fraternal level, and the two states often cooperate in a broad sphere of military, economic, and cultural activities. What might be most interesting to observers, then, is Russia's inclusion on the itinerary. But this was made because of the rapid rapprochement that's been steadily unfolding between both sides over the past couple of years. Russia and Pakistan have moved past the nadir of their late Cold War era relations and recently decided to start off with a fresh slate, driven as they were by shared security interests in Afghanistan, stemming most immediately from Daesh's involvement in this theater. This neo-realist imperative served as the fuel for bringing the two former rivals closer together on all fronts, which has since seen them signing energy deals and carrying out their first ever joint military exercises last fall. Nevertheless, the original reason for their rapprochement is still the strongest driving force behind their relation, and it's in view of this that the Pakistani foreign minister will soon be traveling to Moscow. It should be said, in connection with their Afghan coordination efforts, that the Russian capital has already hosted three rounds of talks on Afghanistan, each of which included Pakistan. So there's already a tremendous amount of positive working relations between both sides, which will serve as a firm bedrock for the foreign minister's upcoming visit. In terms of tangible expectations, it might not be immediately clear what Mr. Asif's visits will yield, since a lot of what Pakistan is looking for at this moment is to garner behind-the-scenes support in assembling a multilateral effort to peacefully oppose Trump's aggressive posturing against Islamabad. It's been reported that Pakistan plans to host a conference after Mr. Asif's travels to highlight its indispensable contribution to the war on terror and contradict the U.S.'s infowar accusations that it's providing safe havens for terrorists. Correspondingly, this forthcoming diplomatic media effort will probably see the participation of Chinese, Russian, Turkish, and other experts. So in this sense, it's very important for Pakistan to prepare for this event by sending its foreign minister to the relevant countries beforehand. Moreover, Mr. Asif's upcoming visits and the prospective conference afterwards will probably see progress being made on holding a fourth round of the Moscow peace process sometime in the future, which would be a powerfully symbolic statement that would sharply contrast with Trump's planned military escalation in Afghanistan. The next one up is the news that more than 70 terrorist gangs have united into a 25,000-strong force in northwestern Syria. This ominous announcement was made by the head of the main directorate of the Russian General Staff, General Igor Karabov, during a roundtable event last week at the Army 2017 International Military Technical Forum held outside of Moscow. According to the intelligence chief, al-Nusra forms the core of this configuration and has attracted the membership of dozens of so-called moderate rebels to its ranks. This new terrorist front is called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and is based in Idlib region, which is poised to see the implementation of the fourth de-escalation zone in the near future. Those plans might be hampered due to the newfound will of the terrorists to band together and resisting the joint Russian, Turkish, and Syrian efforts to make tangible progress on bringing peace to this region. It comes at a sensitive time too, because the Syrian Arab Army is making rapid gains in the dash for Deir ez-Zor in trying to beat out its Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces rivals in liberating Daesh's last stronghold. For the moment then, it doesn't appear as though the Syrians have the interest or potentially even the manpower to commit an untold number of troops to this forthcoming campaign, which is why they might likely hold off from commencing any offensives in this region until Daesh is defeated in the east and the battlefront stabilizes between them and the Kurds. In the meantime, the terrorists shall probably be bombarded by airstrikes carried out by the Russian aerospace forces as they seek to soften them up in anticipation of the eventual offensive, which could even possibly see the participation of neighboring Turkey. It's here where it's important to qualify a few points, the first being that while there isn't any official coordination between Ankara and Damascus, it's likely that Moscow is intermediating between the two and acting as a broker for bringing them together in some anti-terrorist capacity or another. The second thing to point out is that Turkey may have withheld from its threat to launch another conventional military intervention in northern Syria against the Kurds out of the fear that it'll get bogged down in a quagmire there. It would make it unable to participate in any future incursions in Idlib, the latter of which could possibly be done under the aegis of implementing the so-called de-escalation zone there as part of its responsibilities as one of the guarantor powers alongside Russia and Iran. For domestic political reasons in both Syria and Turkey, both sides will probably not acknowledge any coordination with the other in this case, though if such a scenario unfolds, it can be assumed to have taken place with the wink and a nod approval of both parties following a presumably Russian-brokered solution. However it plays out, sooner or later, Syria, Russia, and likely even Turkey will have to coordinate their efforts in order to most effectively destroy the new Daesh 2.0 terrorist menace that's rising in Italy. Third in our countdown is former Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra fleeing her country in order to avoid being sentenced on corruption charges. Mrs. Shinawatra was deposed in the May 2014 military coup spearheaded by current Thai leader Prayut Chan-o-cha in order to quell the rising unrest and street violence that she allowed to occur on her watch. The background into what happened is very complex, but to overly simplify it, her red shirt supporters had formed militias to aggressively oppose their protesting yellow shirt opponents, who were upset at a wide array of issues ranging from the government's suspected corruption to the need for urgent political reform. The resulting chaos that was unleashed posed a very real threat to national stability, hence why the military carried out its 11th successful coup in seeking to prevent the country from slipping into civil war, which was the trajectory that Thailand was quickly moving along because of the irreconcilably different national outlooks of the two clashing sides. In a nutshell, the red shirts are mostly poor and rural supporters of Thaksin Shinawatra, a wealthy businessman and Yingluck's older brother who used to be prime minister until he himself was overthrown in a military coup in 2006. Thaksin is suspected of controlling Thailand by proxy during the term of his sister's rule, having left the country just as she would later do in order to avoid prosecution on corruption charges. It's notable that the red shirts are opposed to Thailand's monarchy, and the north and northeastern regions of the country are their bastions of support. The yellow shirts, on the other hand, have been fervently opposed to this pro-American family for years, and these mostly middle-class monarchy supporters typically hail from the central and southern parts of Thailand. Following her 2014 ouster, Yingluck was charged with corruption for allegedly carrying out a costly rice subsidy scheme that cost Thailand billions of dollars, as she supposedly sought to reward her and her brother's red shirt supporters in the north and northeast. The former prime minister had previously vowed to remain in the country and was very insistent on making the point that she wouldn't ever flee from what she had claimed was a politically motivated show trial, which is why it totally shocked her supporters that she left the country on the day of her verdict. Instead of turning into the political martyr that her supporters were sure that she'd become, she has now cowardly escaped from justice and is probably in Dubai with her brother, at least according to some reports. Yingluck's actions have left the red shirts suddenly leaderless and therefore devastated their movement. Looking forward, one can expect the red shirts to either dissipate as a political force or rebrand themselves as a strictly anti-junta movement publicly disassociated with the shame that the Shinawatra has brought upon them. In any case, they'll probably continue to be used as Thaksin and his US patrons proxies in the country as they seek to make trouble for Thailand due to its irreplaceable transit role in China's ASEAN Silk Road high-speed railway, connecting the Yunnan capital of Kunming with Singapore. But their effectiveness has now greatly diminished, and they pose much less of a color revolution threat than at any time since their original formation. Our runner-up is Trump's tweeted threat to terminate NAFTA. Unloading his frustrations at the pace of the NAFTA renegotiation talks with Canada and Mexico, Trump tweeted last weekend that, quote, "We are in the NAFTA, worst trade deal ever made, renegotiation process with Mexico and Canada, both being very difficult, may have to terminate," end quote, thereby implying that he was considering the U.S.'s withdrawal from one of the largest free trade agreements in history. Trump embraced a populist approach on the campaign trail towards NAFTA, and this surely isn't the first time that he's threatened to pull out of it. But after having already left the Trans-Pacific Partnership on the first day of his presidency, there's a certain edge of credibility to what he's saying. That being said, it's far from certain that he'll actually do this, let alone anytime soon, and his words could have just been a tactic to put pressure on his counterparts. Furthermore, there are a couple arguments as to why Trump isn't serious in carrying through with this threat. The first one is that most of the U.S.'s trade is conducted with Canada and Mexico, so abruptly pulling out of NAFTA or initiating a phased withdrawal from it, similar to the UK's Brexit process with the EU, could lead to many unintended economic consequences for Americans, whether producers, consumers, or workers. Even though the country could obviously weather any of these consequences, it also needs to be factored in that some segments of American big business would be inordinately affected, and that their globalist lobbyists and the Trump administration will do whatever they can to prevent their interests from being damaged. This is even more powerful of a force to keep in mind nowadays following the Kelly, McMaster, Pence deep state coup and successfully ousting nationalist figures such as Steve Bannon, Sebastian Gurka, and others from the White House. On the other hand, there are a few reasons why Trump might actually do what he's implying. There's a chance that he's dead set on executing one of his main campaign promises, and that he'll terminate NAFTA if he doesn't get a better, renegotiated deal like he wanted. Relatedly, this would have grand strategic ramifications by fundamentally shaking up the global economy and radically rewiring it. The resultant aftershocks would affect the whole world and could even be paired with tougher economic measures against China, which Trump is also supposedly considering right now. The intent behind this move could then be reinterpreted as a dramatic power play for reshaping international relations and triggering a domino effect of economic nationalism all across the world, which could give the U.S. the edge by being ahead of the pack in this regard, while setting into motion large-scale system-changing processes designed to counteract China's new Silk Road globalization model. At our top spot, we've got China and India coming to a mutual understanding in defusing the border drama that's damaged their relations all throughout the summer. The timing couldn't have been better, as it occurs just 1 week before the Chinese city of Xiamen hosts the 9th BRICS summit. Per the reports that have streamed in since then, both sides agree to disengage their forces from the Donglang Plateau, also called Doklam in India, though Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokeswoman Hua Chunying told reporters that, quote, "The Chinese Frontier Defense Force will continue to patrol and garrison in the Doklam area. The situation at the spot has changed, and China will adjust and deploy according to the current situation," end quote. But also crucially remarking that China will, quote, "exercise its sovereign rights according to the historical treaty and guard its territorial sovereignty," end quote. From the look of things, it appears as though India backed down in the face of China's recent hints that it could resort to military force to protect its territory, though there might be more going on than meets the eye behind the scenes, and it could be that both sides truly did agree to de-escalate the situation through a coordinated downscaling of their troops, and that the Chinese statement is for domestic consumption more than anything. However, it's much more believable that it's India's inference about a mutual withdrawal which is directed at its own domestic audience, and as a face-saving measure at that, since this allows Prime Minister Modi to attend the upcoming BRICS summit and hold one-on-one talks with President Xi without being dogged by the Donglang drama. At this point, it's insightful to dwell on the reason why Modi would want to go to Xiamen so bad that he'd disappoint his hyper-nationalist followers in visibly backing down from his country's chest-thumping brinksmanship. BRICS is no longer anything close to the cohesive geopolitical force that its most zealous supporters fantasized that it was, owing to the divergent grand strategic directions of India and China in moving closer to the US and Russia in the new Cold War, respectively, as well as their dueling competitive connectivity projects of the so-called Freedom Corridor and the new Silk Road, correspondingly. Nevertheless, both Asian great powers still retain a shared interest in reforming the global economic and financial systems, which is what the focus of BRICS has lately turned into. Though, because of the Donglang drama, Modi would have been unable to visit China to advance multilateral cooperation on this front without infuriating his jingoistic base. Considering that India was the party which started this dispute, and that China says that it will still patrol and garrison Donglang after the Indian withdrawal, it appears as though New Delhi decided to engage in a tactical retreat after failing to achieve its desired concessions from China, which may have also been related to North Korea if one believes that the timing of India's actions was intentionally coordinated with the US's aggravation of the Korean crisis earlier this summer. For now, at least, it looks like the geopolitical contradictions between India and China, whether naturally occurring or provoked by outside actors, aren't yet strong enough to override the common interest between them in reforming the global economic and financial systems. But that another crisis might be all that it takes to sabotage their delicate relations once and for all. All right, folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend, and you'll tune in again next week. Thanks. Bye.